This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 21st of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's show dedicated to the world of design. Coming up today, we continue our coverage of the Farrell Review to look at the prospect for change in the United Kingdom with architect Sir Terry Farrell.
There is this huge amount that's built without architects or without clients that are interested in quality. It's about how do you get quality demanded, accepted.
Roll up, roll up. It's fair trade season. This week, we report from Bread and Butter in Berlin, Home in London, and the IMM Furniture Fair in Köln.
These things we try to do in order to show that we are going forward and we know where the trends are going and as well that we are among the trendsetters.
And Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson reflects on some of the week's design stories coming out of Japan.
I think there's a feeling that a lot, certainly among designers, that the time has come. And there are a couple of key collections that are coming up that may come up for sale and may go somewhere else. And I think there's a feeling that, no, we really need to have a home for all this very good design in Japan.
All that and more here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. In March last year, UK Minister for Culture, Communications and Creative Industries, Ed Vasey, commissioned the Farrell Review, an investigation into the United Kingdom's architecture and the built environment. The man behind the review is, of course, world-renowned architect Sir Terry Farrell, whose work, over a 50-year career, includes the design of London's MI6 building and China's enormous KK100 tower in Shenzhen. The review will explore, amongst many other things, the role of the architect in today's society, the role of the government and the public, and the education of those involved in the profession and those affected by it. It seeks, in its words, to bring about positive change. No small task ahead, then. The review is on the cusp of being published, and in the first of a two-part interview looking at the Farrell Review, Sir Terry sits down with Section D's producer, Alad John. Alad began by asking if he was daunted by the task.
I take on things very optimistically and enthusiastically. I'm an enthusiast by nature. So I wasn't daunted. It's a bit like having a child, really. If you really knew what the trouble was, if everyone spelled out to you just what it would be like them going through their GCSEs and A-levels and getting married, you would have a bit of a rethink at the outset. But I think it's been great, actually. I've learned a lot. It's been a really, really good experience. I just hope it's helpful.
Before we get onto the themes which you address in the review, which are, we'll detail later, but design quality, the role of government, education, the role of the architect, one of the phrases used by Max Farrell in a press conference he gave was that it was to bring about positive change, and that reflects that there is a need for positive change. In your eyes, what needs to change with the themes of architecture and the built environment in the UK?
Well, the biggest thing about architecture and built environment is that I am trying to communicate that it isn't owned by a profession. The profession is great. They do very, very well, and their institute does very well. But it does a mere fraction of the built environment. First of all, the new bits are the minority bits. Most of the stuff exists already. And secondly, most buildings aren't built by most architects, only a fraction of them. So it's a good thing, is architecture and all the built environment designers, but they are a small bit of the whole picture. And it's a bit like health and doctors, because health is far bigger than doctors. It's your diet. It's your physical fitness, which extends way beyond what your doctor is involved in. And I think the same with architecture. Architecture built environment is owned in part by everybody, and that is the big issue. And that's what I've addressed. I've tried to put the whole thing in context.
And that context is then that the public needs to realise they have a voice within the process of building.
They have a voice. and they have a responsibility. And I've addressed schools, school education, kids, adult education, who's on a planning committee, and what do you know about your street, your town, and have suggested ways that everybody can, you know, to use the current word, to be empowered to think that they are part of the future built environment. And by the future, I mean the future of the stuff we have now. 80% of all our buildings will still be with us in 2050. But they'll be modified, they'll be shifted, they'll be insulated, there'll be extensions built on them. That's all part of the big picture.
So taking a look now at the themes addressed by the review, let's begin with the first one, design quality. It's a theme which, obviously, close to the heart of many an architect, many a graduate. Good design, good architecture is a very important thing. Do you see that this is an element of the planning process, of the building process in the United Kingdom, which is now lacking?
I think the biggest failure in our villages, towns and cities is the everyday. But we're not alone in failing there. Most cities are growing. You know, there's 9 billion people now. We keep doubling in population across the globe in short shrift. And so we're building cities. We're becoming urban creatures. 1850, we became the first nation to have more people living in towns than in agricultural situations. Now, all the world lives like that, and very soon it'll be 60-70% of a much bigger population. So we live in what we've built. We're an urban building creature. The human beings have become that. I call it the urbicultural revolution rather than the agricultural one. So I think it's bigger than what architects do. But what architects do is they set agendas, they set priorities, they influence. I want to make this review, encourage them to be more like activists, where they volunteer much more, that they help in schools, they help adults and the general population through what I call urban rooms. So every village, town and city should have a place where you can go and see a model or access a virtual representation of your place. So people begin to really understand the past, the present, and all the alternative futures for where they live.
What would you say the role of the architect is at the moment then? Let's begin with the public sector. The proportion of architects working amidst planning committees is significantly less now than, say, even 20 years ago.
Architects have no longer the power and influence they used to have. And I think that they were over-powerful and over-influential and allied to top-down politics. It was the politicians, in the end, that in a dominant state commanded the high ground. But architects were close to them. And I think the Greenfield universities, the new towns, motorways through our cities and which we didn't need, comprehensive development and building mass housing estates, I think architecture and architects, the profession is perceived to have blood on its hands from that era. I think now that they should reemerge and work with a much more informed public. They are needed because the public does need people who understand and know. But on the other hand, the public is becoming much better informed, like medicine. You can look at your website and look up bunions or flu or whatever, and equally, you can look up planning law. You can look up house extensions. You can look up where to get a good kitchen. You don't have to go to a specialist. But architects add quality, colour, style, design, above all, quality to life.
Yeah, the man on the street can research planning law and contractors can make buildings. But what do you say to the state of design coming out of a lot of the planning situations in the UK? There is obviously a need for good design.
The fact is, during my career, which is nearly 50 years, I've seen design quality go up and up and up. The quality of architecture produced by architects is just improving continuously. And there are, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 times more architects than there were before. So there is far more product there and far more sensitively and thoughtfully done. But it's still the minority because there is a vast amount already there and there is this huge amount that's built without architects or without clients that are interested in quality. It's about how do you get quality demanded, accepted. We've had a revolution in food. We eat much better, the British do. We were a joke 30 years ago. We've had the same in house interiors and furniture. Before Conran, before IKEA, before minimalism, before style and your architectural magazines and the media, 30, 40 years ago, it was pretty awful. So there has been cultural shifts. I think architects should be much more actively involved in that cultural shift. And in schools, in your town, village and city, they should be out there promoting and arguing and advocating.
Sir Terry Farrell in conversation with Alla John. And you can hear the second part of that interview on next week's show. Coming up, we stay in the UK to visit the Home Trade Show, where we talk interiors.
Cityscapes have inspired filmmakers for generations, and this year we sent a film crew to the Architecture Film Festival in Rotterdam to explore common themes found in building real and imaginary worlds.
In film, you can tell what's behind the walls. You can tell about the conflicts people have, the social aspects. And as filmmakers, in essence, are interested more or less in those conflicts, you can tell what's behind the facade.
Passion, obsession, idealism, architecture on film. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. For the past 2 years, the trade show Home has been one of the main stops for UK retailers on the hunt for well-designed interior accessories. This year's show concluded last week, so we sent Monocle's Hayley Joel Ott to check out what will soon be gracing the shelves of London's high streets.
The 2014 Home Show at Earl's Court can best be described as sprawling. Situated between two other trade shows, walking through Home feels a bit like being trapped in the chateau of some eccentric, and by eccentric I mean insane, billionaire. Retailers transform their booths into self-contained spaces to best present their merchandise and characterize their brands. And while this tactic may be effective, its overall result is frankly a bit much. But this year, as it has done for the past two, Home managed to curate a well-thought-out show that presented retailers with a myriad of well-designed products with which to stock their stores. Ian Rudge, who's the brand director for Home, caught up with me at the event and told me what he noticed design-wise during the organizing process.
You can always sort of identify the immediate trends, and you look at it and think, right, well, there's loads of blue objects here, and there's a lot of copper. You know, so, and this is something that's sort of been going on for a little while, but if I would say anything, right, from this show, there's a lot of copper, there's a lot of blues, you know, there's less of the decoration, which is good, you know, and then there seems to be more of a return to a sort of slightly more minimal design, but with colour, and still quite a lot of humour as well. But, you know, there seems to be a move towards more sophisticated design, particularly in tableware and pots and pans and so on. But, you know, more whites with sort of coloured linings and so on. But good quality and a sort of semi-matte finishes, lots of those.
So what were the highlights? One, which probably comes as no surprise, was Sebastian Conran's new line of kitchenware. Called Universal Expert, it's launched in the US but has only recently been put out in the UK, at West Elm and John Lewis. It is affordable and designed simply and cleanly, with priority placed on functionality and sustainability. Sebastian talked me through it.
We've got four basic collections here: storage and utility, cooking and preparation, share and serve, and sink and countertop. We've used porcelain, beechwood, stainless steel, and glass. So we've used traditional materials along with cork, We're trying not to use polymers wherever possible. Everything we've got here has got a functional innovation and is that much better than the stuff that's out there. There's a reason for it to be. It's not just what it looks like, it's how it works. So there's a lot of focus on that. And so we've got these stacking cups with saucers that double as lids. We've got this toast rack, which fat toast goes diagonally and slim toast goes horizontally. We've got salt and pepper grinders with nice wide tops so you can see what's inside them and they're easy to fill. We've got a bread bin over here where the flat, the front flaps down and you can saw the bread on there and it's got room for a toaster on top. A chopping station which is nice and solid and robust, so you can chop on it and just do that, and then you've got a nice lightweight tray to bring stuff to your pans with.
And do you have a favourite product?
Oh, it's like saying, do you have a favourite child?
I know, but sometimes you get asked
I really like the, this is a turkey-sized chopping board, and you can use it with or without the board in there. We've been serving cheeses on it today. I mean, this snack and serve range has been particularly successful.
But the show wasn't just kitchenware. There was lots of furniture, and I was excited to see that designers of larger items were editing out the frills and getting down to sleek, functional basics. One display that particularly caught my eye was by furniture brand Another Country. Set up inside what was ostensibly a little house, the merchandise was mostly simple, unpainted wood with strong lines and gentle curves. I asked founder and owner, Paul Desvart, to tell me more.
We're setting indeed in our sort of chalet, our Norwegian 30 square meter bungalow. We premiered the house at Design Junction last year, and we are repurposing it for different shows. Within our booth, or you know, calm chalet, are three furniture series: series 1, 2, and 3. Three being the newest, launched last autumn, as well as showing you a range of homewares and textiles, some new and some we've had for a while.
And so, can you explain your brand to me? What can people expect when they hear about Another Country?
Another Country, as I mentioned, it was launched 3 years ago. We are a contemporary craft brand. We are more of a collective of people. We design mainly in-house, and we designed items that have longevity and are fairly priced. So we design an archetype, we build to last, and we equally, through designing on art based on archetype, we also design to last. So the brand is invariably and inherently sustainable in the way it does business. And you know, it's all made of solid timbers. And it really picks up on different design trends. So we speak of being influenced by Scandinavian design, by English cabinetry making, by Japanese woodworking, and an American shaker. And those four sort of design influences inform the aesthetic of the brand. So just walking over to our stool one, which I'm just picking up.
And I mean, it looks like a butter stool.
It's like a butter stool, like a milking stool, and you can hear that it's made of solid oak. This was the genesis of the collection and of the brand, for that matter. It came really from a quest to find an archetypal stool that was fairly priced, well made from solid timbers, and had sort of classic proportions. And Stool One does all of that. So it's a stool that, obviously, as mentioned, is inspired by the sort of classic butter milking stool, albeit it is a bit higher. So you can actually sit at it at a proper height rather than crouching down.
I mean, moderately higher. It's still quite moderately a small. Higher.
Yes, but this is even lower. And I'm pointing to what is a kid's stool. And I see that is properly low. But the proportions of the stool really epitomize the brand. So it's all about materials. It's all about proportions. And it's not about decoration or ornamentation. And as you can see, it's a very contemporary piece, but it's also a classic piece. And that's why the longevity is sort of built into the design.
All in all, this year's home show was mammoth, as it always is. And though there was a bit of tack, every once in a while I'd round a corner and smash into a booth stuffed with tiny dolls or mass-manufactured coffee mugs, what was generally on display indicates a return to clean, simple, functional home decor. And frankly, it made me want to go buy a milk stool. For Monocle in London, I'm Haley Joel Ott.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, let's cross to Germany. Bread and Butter is Berlin's independent fashion trade show featuring brands from around the world and focusing on casual wear in the mid-range market. Launched in 2001, it complements Berlin Fashion Week with its two annual editions and has slowly been gaining a reputation for showcasing brands who have decided against showing Milan and Paris, which it runs against. We sent Nelly Gotcheva to explore the latest offerings by established names and newcomers as well.
Bread and Butter has been around since 2001, and it is today known as Berlin's edgier fashion gathering. It runs for 3 days twice a year, and this January, the 600 brands on show are displaying their autumn-winter 2014-2015 collections. Here we meet some established names and big players such as Victorinox, Canada Goose, Penfield and Carhartt. But also, there are plenty of bread and butter newcomers, like Italian Museum and Detroit-based Cianola. First, I stop by the booth of Italian high-end jacket maker Museum, who are at the show for the first time. I ask Eduardo Ambrosini why they are at Bread and Butter and how important the German market is to Museum.
It's our first time in Bread and Butter, actually, and we are happy because there was a lot of work yesterday and today. And the German market is very important. We work with this German market since the beginning, so it's a very important market for us.
For a company that makes everything in Italy, I know that you stress a lot on quality. Do you think that quality and the made in Italy label is still important for people and for customers?
Of course it is, yeah. We do jackets, so we want people to wear jackets and to feel warm. So the quality for this is very important, and we all just, that's why we use only French duck down, for example, and we are stressed for the feeling power of the down. We try other down to find the perfect one, and so the quality is very, very important.
The longevity of your products is also very important, I know, and it's mostly due to the high quality of your fabrics. Can you just tell me more about this? I know that you have a key jacket that is made with Loro Piana fabric, so can you just explain more about this?
Loro Piana fabric is a storm system, it's called, and is a wool cashmere, and is made in Italy. It's waterproof, windproof, and so it's a very, very soft, very like a cashmere, but it's very sport, it's very technique, and you have to feel it, yeah.
And we kind of cover your European markets. You're based in Italy as well, and you just told me about Germany. Can you, if you move further away from Italy and Europe, what are your biggest markets?
German, it's our biggest market outside Italy, yeah. Outside Europe, it is South Korea now, yeah. Yeah, South Korea.
Are you guys big in the US or North America? Are you planning to expand further over there? Or
absolutely, yeah. This winter, for the next winter actually, we will have the collection in the US, so with an agent, and we actually want to expand over Europe, also Canada, also UK, actually, and South Korea, and maybe in the future Japan.
After Museum, I head to Victorinox. Mostly known for its iconic Swiss Army knife, the heritage brand is at Bread and Butter to present its new autumn-winter collection, courtesy of artistic director Christopher Rayburn. Simon Walker talks me through the inspiration behind the new collection, but we also talk business and international market expansion plans.
It's a very important fair for us. We've been here for several years now. I think this season we've come to market with a much stronger product line, a much clearer image as well as a brand. And we take away a lot of clutter and we present ourselves a lot more in a more simple way so we can communicate more clearly what we stand for.
And because here you're showcasing your fashion line, so can you just tell me about some of the key pieces and fabrics that you are introducing this season, or actually next season, fall winter 2014-2015?
Absolutely. This season we're playing more with natural fabrics. So we've always had a lot of travel nylon and poly in the collection because it's water repellent and it's wrinkle free, so it's very travel friendly. But this time Christopher wanted to bring wool to the collection for the first time. So we're using a Melton wool, but it's bonded with a lamination, so it's water repellent wool. We're mixing that with a very famous fabric called Schola, which is from Switzerland, which is where we're from, which makes a lot of sense. And this acts like a pine cone. So when a pine cone is cold, it goes very tight. And when the climate changes to warmer, it opens up. So this fabric works very similar to a pine cone. So it keeps you warm when it's cold, and when the temperature changes, the fibers open to keep you cool.
What are your biggest markets, and where are you kind of aiming to promote this product?
Well, North America is very important for us. It's one of the longest standing markets for travel gear and fashion. But also Asia is exploding. You know, Japan, we have a great number of franchise stores in Japan, so we have a huge following there. Europe is coming. We're quite young in Europe, let's say 4 years in total. But I would say that 2014 is going to be a big tipping point for the brand in Europe. We're finding this season more than ever with all the advertising and the marketing we've done, and with Christopher's halo effect on the brand, because everybody loves Christopher. We're now attracting a lot more big department stores curious to come and see what it's about. They love the story, the heritage, and I think we're delivering a very powerful story this season, which people can buy into.
For Monaco at Bread and Butter Berlin, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
Coming up, Josh Fennett reports from the IMM Interiors Fair in Cologne, and Aled discusses the week's design stories in Japan with our bureau chief there, Fiona Wilson.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock, whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Now, it's been a busy couple of weeks for the Monocle team and its key eye for fashion and design. We've been menswear mad so far this January, rallying through the rails at Pitti Uomo before we headed to Milan and Paris for the men's fashion shows. But January also sees the design calendar kicking off for 2014 with the IMM Furniture Fair in Cologne. Our roving reporter Josh Fennett took a tour of the Interiors Fair in Germany last week and brought us this.
Every January, over 130,000 furniture designers, manufacturers, retailers and appreciators gather in the city of Cologne to take the temperature of the European interiors industry. Here in the vast Kohlmesser exhibition space, 11 halls brimming with everything from cushy sofas to stylish side tables, fixtures and fittings, go to show that business is part of the furniture here in Cologne. First, I speak to Mirko Kullberg, CEO of Finnish design firm Artek. Despite a strong following in the Nordics, the brand's takeover by Swiss giant Vitra has given it renewed scope to showcase its Scandinavian style to a wider audience, as Kullberg explains.
In general, if you think of from consumer perspective, I don't think that none of us really want to make just an Artek home or Vitra home or any international brand home, just it would be just one brand only. I think together we will be able to offer much wider and much more beautiful interiors for the consumers and even for the office side and cafes and the public sector. There's a great opportunity to blending these collections, and it's bringing the Nordic masters together with the European masters. I think this is the most fabulous collection which these companies are able to offer together, and there we are.
So it's about letting the design kind of speak for itself, and how important is it to come to fairs like this? How important is it to come to Cologne to to show off your new designs, but also to renew the contracts with suppliers, talk to people, meet the press? Yeah. How important are fairs like this, and are they becoming more important, do you think?
Yes, you know that my background is from fashion, and the fashion fairs used to be very active, like a sales perspective, and then they turned to be more like a communication platform. And the same thing is also with the design sector. It's super important to go where the people gathers and where they come together. And especially with this Cologne Fair, it's very important from the German-speaking Europe perspectives, because here comes the people who are on the sales floor, who are working with the final consumers and customers. To Milan, it's more like the management which will be there. So this is very much about educating the sales teams and getting the connections with them. It's important to be here.
So it's interesting. So it goes all the way down the line. It's not just about the managers. It's not just about impressing the bigwigs. It's about, showing everyone, telling everyone. And I guess important for Germany particularly. How strong is the German market for Artek and the middle European market?
The middle European market has been in Artek focus when we established the offices and international headquarters into Berlin. And we knew that we need to be here locally acting. And now when we finally have Vitra's resources and sales teams just working for us, it's the most important market. And it will be the most important market for us in the future.
And I know you're busy and you haven't got all day to talk to me, but tell me a little bit about Artek in the year ahead. What you've got planned, how you see it developing. You mentioned that you've actually launched a new chair here today, taken from the archive. Will there be more, you know, will there be more things coming up in future design fairs? Will we see you in Paris in next week's time? Well, you know, talk us through the year ahead.
The one of the big events is, of course, Milan. So we will be coming with a great new product there, or actually a series of products, great collaboration with designers we are working with, also with even with these classical pieces. They will be looking totally new there. Then we are focusing also with the ABC collection, which is more accessories and object, and that will be in Maison Objet. That will be a big launch for that. In general, I think that we will be more and more looking for the distribution. What is the future distribution? And I hope, I'm really hoping that we will be able already in next year bringing some kind of new ideas of thinking completely new perspective. And one, the first pilot and project will be in the Bikini House in Berlin, opening in the beginning of April. There you will be seeing the first signs, but it will be a surprise. But Artek will be definitely more recognized brand even what it is today. Today it has been maybe, the brand has been sort of polished and it's great and vibrant. And then I'm hoping and I'm believing that it will be for a wider audience after a year.
Despite playing second fiddle to the Middle East trade show Salone del Mobile, IMM is still an important platform for firms from around Europe. As Evelyn Hummel, the managing director of Augsburg-based modular furniture brand Müller explains, the tides have begun to turn in favour of the East German city.
So in the very beginning, the Cologne Fair was one of the most important fairs, and then it was slowing down. It was always very international, a very international fair. The people came from all over the world. And about 5 years ago, it was... It changed. Everybody was going to Milan. Suddenly Milan was coming much more important. But in the last years, we see that the international people coming back. So it's almost getting more important than Milan.
Can you maybe guess what the reason is? Is it to do with Germany's economy? Is it to do with the fact that there are a lot of retailers here, that the buyers are interested in design? What do you think is the reason?
Yeah, could be that Germany is the reason for that. And you can see that the difference, for example, is of course that the people here, the visitors, they are buying. It's the difference to Milan. In Milan, it's more for orientation or for having a good time.
So it's all business here. That's certainly something I've noticed from going around and talking to people. Trying to get an interview with people is impossible because there is so much business being done. There's a lot of hands to shake. People are placing orders. People are buying things. Let's talk about your collection. I can see a lot of new items in front of me. I've seen your desks before, but there's a lot more modular furniture and shelving. Can you tell me about it?
Mm-hmm. So there's quite a big change in our collection now. We started with this retro stylish furniture. What we are doing now is we built up a very new system, a modular system, where you can have endless sideboards. You can build them up in the height. You can have all lengths. You can choose different levels. You can put in different boxes. So it's completely your own design.
And what's the reason modular furniture has become so popular? Is it to do with hiding mess? Is it to do with things looking neater? Is it to do with the fact that you can customize it? What are the reasons modular furniture is so big? I mean, you have companies like USM and Vitra making beautiful shelving, but there's clearly room in the market for others. I mean, why is that?
Well, I think it's the reason is how the people are living now. They're moving from places to places. They need furniture who can be rebuilt in a different style. And we see a very good feedback from this.
From a German furniture firm to Finnish woodworkers, there's a consensus here that face-to-face business is still important to the fair and the only way to really get a feel of the best of what's on offer. As Helen Luffner, the exports manager of Finnish firm Lundia, explains.
To be honest, the first day was maybe a bit slower compared to last year. Today has been very, very good. And of course, it's the quality and not the quantity. And fairs are very important for us. Especially here, we get to meet the retailers we have and as well look into how we want to expand the network that we currently are working with.
So you say this is your third time at the fair. How important is it for you to get your designs seen around Germany and by the international audience? How important is it to a company like yours?
It's very important, actually. And I would say my feeling is that being once at a fair, then you the industry sees you as a one-hit wonder and you don't get that trust. So coming many times is in that sense important. So I still see that for us 3 to 5 years is minimum, and for us it's building up the trust and then meeting up with existing clients, but as well expanding. And for us, I think the Cologne Fair in that sense is very important because it has a lot of focus on Germany, and that is where we are putting a lot of emphasis at the moment.
So Germany's a big growth market. Obviously, you're a Finnish company, so kind of Middle Europe, but they appreciate the kind of Nordic aesthetic, the craftsmanship, the kind of the more simple, kind of rounded, modern designs. What are the other growth areas for the company? You mentioned before the interview Canada and other places. Where are you looking at next?
Yes, so Japan is as well somewhere where we are exporting now. Where we are looking next? Well, Italy would as well be something interesting. There, the Nordic design is as well coming more and more. And then I would say Denmark is something we want to grow more as well. And for us, it's more that when we go to one country, we really want to build it up well. And then we take it to the next step. And I would say we have now been working in Germany for 1 year, so we still have a lot to do in this market. It is a very big market, and in that sense as well has challenges, and there still for me I want to see our brand well represented here, and that is something we are want to work hard on and put emphasis on. So at the moment those are the markets now we are focusing on, but of course we never say no to interesting opportunities. So looking into as well the US, there are some interesting prospects, so keeping our eyes and ears open.
You were set up, you said, in 1948, so quite an old company and very well established in Finland. Can you tell me a little bit of a background, you know, what's important to the company, why you work with wood, kind of just a little bit of a sense of a kind of profile?
Yeah, so the company, as you said, was established in 1948, and it was a Swedish carpenter actually who came up with the Lundia classic shelving system. And the idea behind it is that you buy certain pieces, and then later on when you move and your needs change, then you can adapt the shelf that you have bought, that you never need to start from the beginning and you never need to throw anything away, that you can always modify and change it according to your needs. And for us, it has been one philosophy that we have, that we want to work with real material and real people. And that is something that you see through our whole organization and as well through our product line. And all the new products as well that we come up with, the whole idea there is always that you can combine and change according to where you go. And a bit against this culture where you just buy something and then you don't need it anymore and throw away. And that is why we as well put a lot of emphasis on quality. The Lundia classic product, for example, it will hold up for more than 50 years. So then if you get bored after 10 years, you just polish it a bit, you can paint it, buy some doors or some drawers, and voila, then it looks completely different and you have a new product, and the investment was actually minimal.
So obviously at this fair there's lots of new things being exhibited, lots of interesting ideas. You're committed to stand here and talk to people about your products, but do your designers, do your CEO, do they get out at the fair, do they get a chance to see what's new, what's going on, and kind of take inspiration? I mean, how important is the fair for showing people what you're doing, sure, but also learning what other people are doing and kind of gathering trends? Is that an important factor for you guys?
Yes, of course, that is very, very important, and especially if you think that we have had kind of the shelving system since 48, which is close to 65 years. So we need to renew ourselves all the time in order to, of course, we want to keep the old clients, but in order to be attractive for the young up and coming consumers. So we travel to different fairs to get inspiration, to see what is up and coming. And then we work together with different designers who as well travel a lot. And in that sense, which colors are the new trends, or because we are all about storing. How can you store things more efficiently? How can you make it so that it actually is a part of your interior when you design at home, that it there looks nice and then has a function as well. So that is, I think, very essential, and you need to go forward all the time. And as well, we want to be one of the trendsetters. So actually, now talking about that, we have one other new thing as well. We have this augmented reality for all our lamps. So that this app, LND Design app, that you can get from the App Store. And with that one, you just need to have a marker that you put on the floor. And then at home, you can see how the lamp would look in your home in 3D. And all kind of these things as well, we try to do in order to show that we are going forward. And we know where the trends are going, and as well that we are among the trendsetters.
That was Helen Lufner, exports manager of Finnish firm Lundia, speaking to Josh Fennett at IMM Cologne. And to end the show, let's cross now to Japan. Fiona Wilson, our bureau chief there, rounds up the week's design stories with Aled John.
Japan, amazingly, doesn't have a design museum. I guess the first question to ask before we get onto the actual story is, why is that?
I mean, isn't it? It seems ridiculous. Japan, where there are just so many brilliant designers, design is just such a part of life here. I mean, you can't even go into a convenience store without seeing amazingly designed products. I mean, I think really there just hasn't really been that niche in the museum world. The museum world is quite old-fashioned in Japan, strangely, and it's starting to change. I mean, you certainly have a lot of design exhibitions, but there isn't a single organisation that deals with just exhibiting Japanese or, you know, international contemporary design. And I think there's a feeling that a lot, certainly among designers, that the time has come. And there are a couple of key collections that are coming up that may come up for sale and may go somewhere else. And I think there's a feeling that, no, we really need to have a home for all this very good design in Japan.
Okay, it's quite an interesting question, isn't it? Because good design in Japan is so ubiquitous that perhaps because of that ubiquity, people don't feel like it needs to be kind of sort of holed up in a museum because it is part of everyday life. Yeah.
I think you're right. That is so true. I mean, you know, you can't get a plate of food without it being well designed. That, you know, what could be more ephemeral than food? I think that's so true, that good design is really a part of life. If you buy a product in a shop, it's beautifully wrapped. You know, it's just really a part of daily life here in a way I haven't seen in any other country. And I think it's quite hard for people to extract. What would you actually put in a design museum? Would it be objects, or would it be exhibitions about ideas? And I think what people have started to think is, well, what could it be? They're just starting a discussion, really, about what it could be.
So this is, we're talking about this because Issey Miyake and Tado Ando, they've created an exhibition which proposes that Japan should indeed have a design museum.
Yeah, well, actually, it's in 2121 Design Site, as it's called, rather long name for a very, very small museum in Tokyo Midtown, which was designed by Tadao Ando. And it's really, you know, the work of Issey Miyake, the fashion designer. This exhibition has been curated by a group that includes Naoto Fukasawa, who's really probably the key product designer in Japan at the moment. And it's really inspired by an article that Issey Miyake wrote. It's 10 years ago now, 11 years ago, actually, 2003, where he said, the time has come for Japan to have a design museum. And of course, it's in his interest, you know, as someone who exhibits a lot of design. But I think really, more seriously, I think he felt that his work has been exhibited everywhere. You know, it's been in London, huge exhibition at the Victoria and Albert, for example. And of course, his work has been exhibited here. But I think he felt that Japan should have its own museum. And this exhibition basically looks back at all the exhibitions that this little museum, 2121 Design Site, has had. There have been 23 of them since 2007. And it adds up to a sort of conversation about what a design museum in Japan could be.
Is it going some way towards sort of encompassing the various spheres of design? Like you mentioned just before, that something a design museum might struggle with is, in fact, you know, creating a comprehensive enough sort of collection of what good design in Japan might be.
Well, I think that is so, you know, so it's interesting in Japan because, you know, someone like me, I'm very interested in the very functional aspect of Japanese design. The product designers that I've always been interested in are people like Soriya Nagi, who couldn't have been a more functional designer. You know, he designed cutlery, saucepans. And I think that's what Japan has excelled at, this very, very simple, very functional design. But then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got people like Tokujin Yoshioka, who's had a huge exhibition here, actually. He's a designer. He does products, but they're very, very conceptual. There's often a product at the end of it, but he's much more of a thinker. He thinks about the aesthetics in a more artistic way, in a way that someone like Soriya Nagi wouldn't really have approved of, I don't think. But you've got these two ends of the spectrum, the beautiful conceptual and then the very functional, also to my mind beautiful, but in a different way. And I think, you know, what a museum would have to do would be encompass all those aspects of Japanese design. And that's what this exhibition is about. It's not about a particular discipline. It's not architecture or graphic design. It's all of these things and beyond. It's daily life, as you said at the beginning.
Moving on to another exhibition that's taking place. This is an exhibition sort of, well, in tribute to the late Junzo Sakakura, one of Japan's great modern architects. Tell me a little bit about why this exhibition is different and why it's so special to you. I know you're a big fan of his work.
I am. I'm a big fan of Junzo Sakakura. I mean, if you're interested in Japanese modernism as I am, you know, he's one of the absolute key figures. He died in 1969. What's really interesting about Sakakura is he was of a generation of architects that there are a few key architects. They really broke through a new Japanese modernism. It's a different style. But what's interesting about him is that he worked in Paris. He worked in Le Corbusier's studio for 7 years.
He worked with Le Corbusier, didn't he?
He did, yeah. So there's a very direct connection. And they built together the National Museum of Western Art in Tokyo, which is a really interesting building. It's very, very heavily used, very well visited museum. It's a very simple, very Corbusier kind of design, solid blocks. And Sakakura also designed the Museum of Modern Art in Kamakura. And for anyone who's interested in modernism, it's one of the key buildings, the first Museum of Modern Art in Japan. It's a very, very simple building, and it's pretty much been left as it was, interestingly, because they built an annex, but they built it somewhere else. So they didn't tamper with the original building. And it's a really, really interesting structure. And I think, you know, if you're interested in that period, it's a very good vintage of Japanese design and architecture. This is an exhibition you'd love. It's got photographs, drawings. It's kind of a geek's exhibition, and I love it.
Well, you're in good company, Fiona. And also interesting that it's that Japan does in fact have a modern art museum, but perhaps not straddling the line into the design sphere just yet. Let's look now at a big Kyoto design collective. We've only got a few minutes left. So this is Sandwich in a renovated factory led by Kohei Nawa. Talk to me about this.
Well, this is, I mean, verging more on the art side, this is an interesting group of people. It's a huge gang of people. They work in a renovated factory in Kyoto, which is obviously far more famous for its classical art, its traditional architecture. And they work in groups. They do a bit of architecture, a bit of art, sculpture, graphics. They're doing the whole range of things. And there's an exhibition in Omotesando at the moment, just showing films of the kind of work they do. They do very big installations. They've done them all over Asia. Very interesting organic work. I think what's interesting is just that they work as a group, and it's quite interesting. I found the films absolutely fascinating to see how they work. I mean, it really is a group activity. Now, Kohei Nawa is clearly the leader of the gang. He's directing proceedings, but they're all really working hard. And at the end of it, you get these fascinating huge sculptures, huge installations, no practical function whatsoever, but not my cup of tea usually, I have to say. But I think it's just so interesting to see this kind of work coming out of Kyoto, which is, it's a completely different face for Kyoto. I'm very interested in the sort of traditional architecture, so I was fascinated to see this very, very contemporary kind of way of working, to see how it all functions. It was kind of behind the scenes view.
And finally, Fiona, there's been talk of some interesting collaborations, not so uncommon in Japan, but something of a spate of them recently.
I keep getting, you know, messages, emails, press releases about collaborations. I mean, I really think that Tokyo is the ultimate place for collaborations. If you're in the creative industry, everybody knows everybody else. Never a good idea to be rude about someone, because they'll be collaborating with them, you know, at some point in the near future. I just was looking through some of the recent ones. It's absolutely fascinating. You've got young designers like Nendo, a very prolific group of product designers, and they've been working with a very old lacquer company, very traditional lacquer company, Ishikawa Prefecture, and coming up with a completely new product that uses traditional techniques. I also noticed that Isimiyaki, back to Isimiyaki again, he seems to be around quite a lot at the moment. He's done this rather extraordinary light called Mendori, which is, it's quite hard to describe. It's almost like folded paper, but it's actually made from PET bottles, plastic bottles that have been recycled. So there's a sort of organic element. And he's been working with Reality Lab, who've also done a rather interesting shop for him on Omotesando. And last of all, one that I'm really interested in because I absolutely love this furniture company called Maruni. It's a very old furniture company in Hiroshima, and they work with Naoto Fukuzawa, who's the product designer we mentioned at the beginning, who curated the show at 2121 Design Site. And they've come up together with a new range of furniture for another company called Actus. And it's just interesting to see how all these people who might you might think would be in competition are working together to come up with, they've come up with a new range of furniture called Aoyama, appropriately.
That was our Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson bringing us to the end of the show. My thanks to our producer Aled John and to the lovely Holly Fisher for her editing. You can contact Aled at awj@monocle.com if you have any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. And a song to end the show, following our reports from not one but two trade fairs in Germany. This week, here's Peter Fox with Alice Nye. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Ich verbrenn mein Studio, schnupfe die Asche wie Koks. Ich erschlag meinen Goldfisch, vergrab ihn im Hof. Ich jag meine Bude hoch, alles was ich hab, lass ich los. Mein altes Leben schmeckt wie ein labbriger Toast. Brat mir ein Prachtsteak, Peter kocht jetzt feinstes Fleisch. Bin das Update, Peter Fox 1.1. Ich will abshaken, feiern, doch mein Teich ist zu klein. Wir wechseln neue Reihe, weiser wie Bayern.